Hello, a very warm welcome to the 14th episode of the series entitled Gita Decoded. We're still on chapter 3, where we are looking at actions and the impact of actions in our lives, what the particular terms and phrases used in chapter 3 mean, and how we can apply it into our daily lives. Sister Denise has been sharing her views and experience on this deep and informative subject. Sister Denise, a very warm welcome back.
Thank you.
Sister Denise, we start on a curious note in verse 26, which reads that the wise who act without attachment to action should not actually concern themselves with those who do the opposite. And it says specifically that the wise one should cause them to enjoy all actions. This is the unwise, okay? While himself performing actions in a disciplined manner. So it is advice to accept such people the way they are and not try and change them.
No, I think it's extremely good to do that, because can you think of anything worse than the holier than thou? Mm. You know, I am good and you guys are bad. That's not very spiritual.
No, it's not. Or kind.
No. Yeah. No. So if you choose to act in a disciplined way, in a proper way, very good. But don't put it down people's throats. Don't put it in their faces, because it is not really serving anything. It's certainly not going to inspire those people to change their ways. But I think it's very spiritual to be accepting of everyone, understanding that everyone is playing their roles the way they must do according to their destiny, and then get on with the spiritual practice that you choose to do, because it's between you and yourself. And it's not right to, you know, show off or make other people feel bad or whatever.
Yes, Denise, I note that continuing with this theme on page 27, it reads, actions in all cases are performed by the qualities of material nature. And this term, material nature, is taken up in a few stanzas to come. It also reads, he whose mind is confused by egoism imagines I am the doer. Now that part threw me off track of balance, and I'm sure it has done so with a lot of people as well, because if I do this, I am the doer. But now I read in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3, page 27, that is means that I'm confused by egoism if I think I'm the doer. Walk me through how I'm being egotistic in this sense.
When you're doing something which is a pure action and you're saying, I'm the doer of it, you're taking credit where you actually shouldn't be, because you're only able to do pure action because you've been taught by God what to do, how to do, and so on. So if you think you're the doer, it's like you invented the philosophy of karma. You didn't.
Hmm.
It's like that.
My goodness, that is profound.
It is profound.
It's exceptionally profound. So you follow this discipline, mm-hmm, with humility.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Because otherwise you say, oh, you know, I have understood something from God, therefore get rid of God, I know everything. You don't. You're getting into a very egotistical angle, and that is not going to lead to anything good.
Yes. Well, the impression I got is if you are like that, it doesn't serve you to be that way.
No, it doesn't.
And then the next stanza reads, but he who knows the truth, which implies the opposite of egoism, is truth. O Arjuna, about the two roles of the qualities and action, thinking the qualities work among the qualities, is not attached. What does this mean? It's phrased in a very interesting manner.
Well, this is referring, you know, the word qualities is referring to the gunas, you see.
Oh, okay.
And what you have here is material that comes from the Vedas. And You have Sato, Rajo, and Tamo. And if you look at the Raja Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, he goes into that a great deal. But he will go into it from the angle of the Vedas, which in Brahma Kumaris, we look at it in rather a different way. We wouldn't say that the qualities, the gunas, are responsible in quite the same way. But what we would say is that the ages that we're passing through carry certain quality. So, for example, when you're passing through the Satyuga, that carries the quality of Satopradhan. Everything is Satopradhan. Now, you're in the Iron Age, the Kali Yuga, so everything is Tamopradhan. In Brahma Kumaris, we learned about something called Purushottam Sangam Yuga, which is another yuga, another age, which is not talked about, I don't think, anywhere else. And then the idea is that the age in which the Gita is given, the knowledge of the Gita is given, is superimposed on the Kali Yuga. So when God speaks, the impact of what he says in terms of being an era is something that carries people upwards or raises the quality of people, hence the expression Purushottam, the highest of all human. Everything else is going down with the Kali Yuga into a sort of a descent into hell, a descent into the extreme tragedy of the Mahabharata war. So that's the Kali Yuga going that way. And then the Purushottam Sangam Yuga takes another course which leads to a new Satyuga in a new cycle. So this whole change of age involves this sort of additional age of being superimposed on this cusp of two cycles. And that is, of course, the quality of God, which is absolutely Satopradhan, leading to a Satopradhan consequence, while the Tamopradhan defeats its own self and disappears.
The subject of yoga is then brought up again in verse 30, and it starts off with an interesting sentence, deferring all actions in me. Meditating on the Supreme Spirit, having become free from desire and selfishness, with your fever departed. I like that, with your fever departed. Fight. Fight. Is God saying to Arjuna, you fight, but I'm responsible?
Yes.
How does that work in the terms of the law of karma, Sister Denise?
Look again at the idea of sacrifice, you know. And again, the title of the book, Srimad Bhagavad Gita. So you have Srimad, you have Paramat, you have Manmat, these three mats. And those mats means sort of instruction or ideology, something like this. When God speaks, he doesn't talk the same things that everybody else talks. He'll say very different things. Paramat corresponds to the traditions that have been handed down over time, and during the course of time have, like everything else, passed through the stage of Sato, Rajo, and Tamo. And by the time they come here, they are Tamo, they are Tamopradhan, they are at a very low quality. And they clash very strongly. There's a clash between Paramat and Srimat. And then you have this other idea, Manmat. Manmat is the internalized form of Paramat. You know, as a child, you're raised in the tradition and you internalize what was said to you, and that becomes your own ideas. So Paramat and Manmat are all part of the same trend. And then God comes along and tells you something different, which is leading to a different result. And so if you become his student, he gives you instruction and you follow that instruction sincerely and in good faith, he is responsible. He takes it upon himself to be responsible for the consequences of the action you do under his instruction. In the same way, for example, if you hire a killer to assassinate somebody, that killer is going to say to the judge, you know, I'm a hired killer. The person who paid me is so-and-so. And I mean, you would know how the law works for the one who hires a killer. I'm sure that they will be held accountable. It's a similar idea.
Verse 31 goes on to read, men who constantly practice this teaching of mine, capital M, believing, not sneering, are also released from the bondage of actions. Is the bondage of actions different from bondage of karma?
No, it's the same thing. Okay. But the thing is this, there is this concept which we also hear about in the study of Brahma Kumaris, that you can finish off sin through staying in yoga. So how that works is fairly mysterious, but it can be figured out. In terms of how you finish off sin, or how karma gets paid, there's basically three ways. One of them is you pay through illness, through catastrophe of one kind or another that happens to you as you pass through your different incarnations. Another way is that at the end of the cycle, you know, there is this concept of the time of reckoning. And the idea of the time of reckoning is that, you know, the judgment day is mentioned in different scriptures, in different traditions. All the souls come out of their tombs. They're all lined up in front of God, and he will give the judgment. And if they are found to be sinners, then they will be given this or that punishment. You know, you hang upside down in hell over a slow burning fire for 1,000 years, whatever. You see this described in Dante's Inferno. So that's another way. And then the third way is if you keep your mind focused on God, what's going to happen is that all your monsters from your subconscious are going to come up and harass you. And you have to hold yourself so steady on God that you are able to melt those things. And this is what is being talked about here. And this is what we try to practice in Raj Yoga as Brahma Kumaris and Brahma Kumaras.
The aspect of material nature comes up again. One acts according to one's material nature. I'm reading, Sister Denise, from verse 33. Even the wise man does so. So that says to us that irrespective of whether you're wise or otherwise, you're bound by your material nature.
Well, yes, your material nature, we call it body consciousness, and of course that also has to be transcended too, but it is there and you have to deal with it.
I find it very interesting that in verse 34, passion and hatred are mentioned. Mm-hmm. Okay, two fires. That's the image that came to mind as I read this. Passion and hatred are seated in the senses in relation to their objects. One should not come under the power of these two. They are indeed one's enemies. Now, Sister Denise, for those who have embarked on a spiritual journey, we know that there's a lot of enemies that one has. Why is this two vices? Why are these two vices especially highlighted?
You know, when you are attracted, say, particularly this is mentioned mostly, a man is sexually attracted by a beautiful woman and must take her. That's that passion. Hatred is the wish to kill, the wish to destroy. So this wish to possess and the wish to destroy are considered in the spiritual practice to be the most difficult energies to neutralize. This is why they're being identified. This is your exam. This is what you're up against.
I like your choice of words, neutralize.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us more about neutralizing.
The beauty is so powerful, it will take you. And you have to be such a antidote to that, that you can take it or leave it, you know? Which means you have to be absolutely detached from your passion, from your desire, from your from its power to take you, you see, because in both cases you are an absolute slave to your sense perceptions and your sense organs. And in spiritual practice that's considered as absolute failure if you succumb to that. Mm. You know, in the Mahabharata you have the character who abjured the love of a woman in order to make sure that there isn't in subsequent generations some dispute about the kingdom. He was with the Kauravas as the weapons teacher and minister, but he maintained that, even though he wasn't under the tutelage of God, but he maintained it. And what you find in the world today is you have, you know, us Brahma Kumars and Kumaris who say, well, we are being explained everything, we're being taught how to do Raj Yoga by incorporeal God through Prajapita Brahma. But then there's other people who are not following these teachings, but who are operating in a very similar practice, you mm-hmm. see, without that. Mm. And that is absolutely to be honored, you know.
I found verse 35 to be quite thought-provoking, and I'm trying to understand how it fits into the context of the yoga of action. Better one's own duty, though deficient, than the duty of another well performed. Better is death in one's own duty. The duty of another invites danger. What does this mean?
It's connected with the idea of caste duty.
Yeah.
And you have to understand what you're supposed to do and get on with that. You know, what happens in the present day, it's very often the case that somebody will see somebody else is doing something inadequately and they'll go and do it for them, or take over their job or whatever. And that's really not a good way to go. And I think that this is really a stanza that is talking to us about this very important human behavior question, that you must understand what your role is and play your role. Mm. And, you know, don't do grass is greener on the other side or anything like that. Because this whole thing of, you know, the control freak who tries to control everybody, or the somebody who sees what's wrong with this one, that one, and I can do it better and so on, then you'll neglect what you're supposed to do.
Sister Denise, at this stage, we hear Arjuna's voice again, and he asks, then impelled by what does a man commit this evil, unwillingly even, O Krishna, as if urged by force?
Well, this is his dilemma again, because he is under what I would call paramat,
which is
the traditions which say that to take up arms against your relatives is wrong. And God is telling him, well, that may well be the case, but the situation here is such that I'm ordering you to take up arms. And he's still under the traditions and saying, oh, but you can't do that, that's not right. And then Krishna is saying, well, you know, I'm God and I'm telling you what to do. So wakey wakey, do you know who's talking to you?
The answer that he receives from God is very interesting, where the force is described as being desire, anger. Its source is the Rajas Guna, voracious and greatly injurious. Know this to be the enemy. As fire is obscured by smoke, and the metaphor is used, and it continues that the knowledge even of the wise ones is obscured by this eternal enemy. Eternal enemy. He's empowering Arjuna at a deeper level by telling him, this is what you're up against.
He's saying that when you are under the influence of normal human behavior, normal human energies, emotions, motives, and so on, which are going to get the better of you, that is not where it's at. You know, what you have to do is be independent of those things and fight dispassionately.
Dispassionate yet wholeheartedly?
Yes.
Tell us what that means, Sister Denise. Well, because to fight, to win, you need to do it wholeheartedly.
That's right.
And what is then the difference between, or distinction between, wholehearted and dispassionate? Well, because it sounds as if it's like you hot and cold at the same time.
It does. The thing that is being talked about here is the passion that takes a person, the passion of revenge or getting even or whatever. This is what is going to motivate a person to fight. But if you're fighting because it's right, not because you feel like fighting, or you're trying to take revenge, or you're trying to punish someone or something like this, you have to absolutely let go of those emotions and then wholeheartedly do what's right because it's right.
I really like what is contained in verse 40 because it causes a lot of questions to fall into place. The senses, the mind and the intellect are said to be its, in brackets, i.e. the eternal enemy's abode. Okay? With these it confuses the embodied one, obscuring his knowledge. And Sister Denise, we've all been in this position, have we not? You have the knowledge, and yet there's these various fires burning within you, which is your dark side, that even though you have a level of understanding, which is where Arjuna is at the moment, these fires can still destroy you.
Certainly they can. That means that you have to be more powerful than them.
And you achieve that through understanding and?
Through yoga, you see, because you're taking power from God. Without that power, you are less powerful than those fires, so they win every time. But because you're changing the balance of power between yourself and your dark side, you're taking light from God. And the amount of light you have is greater than the amount of darkness that you're up against. Therefore, you can neutralize it.
That is so beautiful. Say that again, the last part.
The amount of light that you take from God, so you have yourself spiritually depleted. You have yoga, which means you keep on taking power, taking light from God, so that the amount of light within you exceeds the amount of darkness of your dark side, and in that case you make the darkness go away by your brightness, and you neutralize it.
That's an extremely powerful image. I see that verse 41 contains the words which destroys knowledge and discrimination. So the power of discrimination comes up again, and the feeling that I get is God is saying to Arjuna, under no circumstances must you lose your power of discrimination. Why is this so crucial in the life of a warrior?
Because you have to see what's in front of you. And if you're seeing what your sense perceptions show you, that's not real, and you have to distinguish that or discriminate that, because you have to be able to see what's real.
Okay.
And then act.
I want to interrupt you there. Arjuna, who represents himself, one man, and yet at the same time all of us, is a man standing before God who cannot see. Does that mean, Denise, that we as human beings cannot see and God can see?
Yes. God gives you the divine intellect, the third eye. That means the information. But you hold it intellectually. But your intellect is weaker than your mind, your monsters, and so on. And so you can lose it when they turn up their volume.
Okay.
And so he's saying, don't lose it.
It's noteworthy that every now and again this word comes up, the expression comes up, the power of discrimination. No, don't lose it. Could you explain what is meant in verse 42? They say that the senses are superior. I'm not sure who they are. Okay, the mind is superior to the senses. Moreover, the intellect is superior to the mind. That which is superior to the intellect is self, capital S. Mm-hmm. What does this mean?
Well, you see, it's very difficult for people to know what a soul is.
Oh, so he's describing the Atma?
He's describing the soul in its pure state. And because of the belief that the soul is part of God, he's put a big S on it.
Okay.
But actually, in Brahma Kumari's Raj Yoga, we would say that the soul is the soul, it's not God. But when the soul is depleted, when the soul is weak, then of course the intellect is weak, and which means the mind has dominion over it, and the mind is ruled by the sense perceptions when the intellect is weak. When the intellect is strong, when the soul has taken light from God, then the mind becomes an instrument for the soul, which enables the soul to perceive what it wants to perceive through the mind. But the mind then becomes under the influence of the intellect. And this is why this is sometimes called yoga of the intellect.
I see that brings us to, well, the last verse of chapter 3. And the last few lines read, "Kill the enemy, O Arjuna, which has the form of desire and is difficult to conquer." I'm going to leave it there, Sister Denise, because we have run out of time. We're actually over. But thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your depth and wisdom on what is an amazing scripture that has sustained Hinduism for so many centuries. So there you have it, chapter 3. I hope you have learnt something. And I hope that you are able to comprehend what Sister Denise has been sharing about what the yoga of action is. And I ask you to look at your life, your own behavior, not someone else's, and ask yourself whether, if you are interested in the Bhagavad Gita, whether your behavior is aligned with that which you believe. On that note, I will bid you farewell. And I do hope to see you soon. Take care and goodbye.